I'm Brian McCreath. I'm at Jordan Hall at New England Conservatory with Richard Tognetti, the artistic director of the Australian Chamber Orchestra. Richard, thank you for a little bit of your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
This is getting towards the last stages of your tour, but this orchestra kind of lives on tour almost. What's the percentage of tour concerts versus home concerts, as you might put it, that this group does?
Mostly touring. I mean, if you include Australia. So, you know, small orchestra will travel. You know, they're cheaper to tour, obviously, than... Well, we're almost the... No, we are just a bit larger than the horn section of the Richard Strauss's Alpine Symphony.
That's a fantastic perspective.
Aren't there something like 13 horns?
It's ridiculous, because there's a bunch of them offstage.
So we're 17 string players on the whole. And, I mean, we've really changed, because we go down to a quintet and up to... doing Beethoven 9 or Xenarchus, Char, or I really want to do the Penderecki Threnody one day, 52 solo strings. But we can't, but we are called a chamber orchestra. We are 17 strings, core, but we add wind players. That's why we're playing a Mozart piano concerto. So, you know, we're small, so we can travel. So we travel... Oh, way more than what we play at home, yeah.
Yeah. And are you the person who makes all of the artistic decisions in terms of programming, or... you laugh. Or what was the process like for this orchestra?
Well, I'm the artistic director, and in most groups, the artistic director is kind of responsible. You know, when things aren't going so well, I take absolutely no responsibility. When things are going well, I take all. Look, the programming... I mean, there are a lot of different... pieces in the puzzle. So we now have a second orchestra called ACO Collective. It's run by Pekka Kuusisto, the terrific Finnish violinist. And the less I have, I'll only, you know, occasionally put my nose into things if things aren't, you know, running smoothly. Never to do with the artistic direction of that group, but yeah, I am the artistic director, so that means I am heavily involved in programming. Always have been. I mean, the programming is, you know, paramount to the success of the orchestra or to any orchestra. Well, there are two things. There's the artistic success and there's the commercial viability of. And both, of course, are combined. But for large symphony orchestras, and tell me if I'm talking too much, but I mean, for large symphony orchestras, they can, let's say, rest on their laurels and just, you know, play the mainstream repertoire in order to make sure that the budget works that year. We can't do that because we don't have much mainstream repertoire. When you look at it, a chamber orchestra really has very little indigenous music to play, you know, particular to the chamber orchestra. So we have to invent and create, rearrange things, arrange things, transcribe things. And so it keeps us on our toes. And as Haydn said, he, you know, when he was stuck on that swamp in Esterházy, he was forced to be original. So I look at it like that with the programming. So it's an integral part. We're always looking at new things. Now, the program that we're playing tonight, Bach, Mozart and Beethoven. Bach is arranged, Art of the Fugue. Mozart, I'm now saying... Since recently I've been performing with a four-day piano. It was a beautiful copy of a Walter, which is pretty much what old Ludwig had at his disposal. And when you play with these pianos, and of course Boston has a proud so-called early music heritage, but when you play on this hardware, let's call it, I can't but help say that the... when you play on a grand piano, it's an arrangement. It's for a totally different instrument. So that's an arrangement. And then, of course, the Beethoven Opus 130 with the Grosse Fugue is an arrangement. So,
But even the Art of Fugue has to be an arrangement of some sort because there was no instrument for it.
Right.
So
exactly.
So tell me the component pieces of this we'll kind of just deal with a little bit. The Art of Fugue has a... can't remember the exact number, but you're doing four of the fugues. How do you choose those?
Yeah.
How do these come together?
Well, so we're in the age of the hybrid, and we're up to, what, post-postmodern? And I'm very, you know, I grew up as a rebel, being in the early music movement. So I was really inspired by the likes of Anna Bijlsma and Frans Bruggen, with whom we worked, and Christopher Hogwood, of course, who has a left something of a legacy here with the Antlion Society, and with whom I performed many, many years ago. And so the early music movement, the so-called HIP, historically informed, which is ridiculous, historically informed performance practice, of the 70s and 80s, creating a style, totally made up style. I mean, we don't have to go into it here, but right. I mean, as I think Richard Tariscan points out, you know, when Harnoncourt was strangely doing a lecture here in the States and someone yelled out, he made some claim and someone yelled out, prove it. You know, and but it's the same with the tonal qualities that you hear on CDs from the early music movements. Prove it. Prove that they are authentic. And if that's authentic, again, Tariscan, or I think I got this idea from Tariscan, is that means everyone else is inauthentic. But nevertheless, it was a style, a sort of... I like to call it a sort of dabbing the Dettol. I don't know if Dettol here, but a kind of dabbing antiseptic on the music and sort of removing it of its alleged bad habits and patina, you know, to reveal the true music. Well, come on, we're beyond that, aren't we? But nevertheless, it created a certain style. Again, Tariscan, a certain sort of clean geometry, if you like. Mm-hmm. And we embraced it, I think, as listeners and some performers. I was included, especially as a student, because it felt rebellious somehow. It felt like, you know, that we were... You've got to sort of... This is, in quotation marks, kill your father in order to grow up as a son. That, you know, it's I'm not making that up.
Yeah.
And so, in effect, it was the best way to sort of murder Karajan. You know, and but unfortunately, you know, and I say this with a wry smile, unfortunately Stokowski was sort of killed at the same time. And so my approach to early music now has changed quite dramatically. I'm now proudly in this sort of, you know, I don't know what pronoun to call myself, you know, when it comes to early music. I'm proudly polystylistic. So I can draw on those sounds that I grew up with in my spirit. Mm-hmm. But I also realized that we kind of threw quite a few things out that we can't prove wasn't there. Mm-hmm. For example, Portamento. Mm-hmm. I mean, we know that definitely that Haydn used Portamento. We know the French used it, different bow strokes and so forth. So I sort of draw on all of these things, especially with the greatest polystylist of them all being Bach, because he drew on, you know, as we know, you know, a French and Italian schools, as well as sort of creating his own, you know, Northern German, all steeped in Lutheran tradition, of course. And so my approach to the art of the fugue is if you just simply play it in a sort of mock Tudor, you know, style of the early music movement of the 1970s, you're missing out on quite a lot. But I take it even further. So we start off, if you like, with that sort of hip, clear sound, but then I move all the way through to the large long line, as we like to say, and I use it a bit sort of sarcastically, because when in doubt, create a long line, you know, of Stokowski, and the using vibrato to move the air in the hall, and I add horns and oboes to the mix, sort of in a subterfuge sort of way. And then the last movement, I'm more inspired by the Swingle singers. And I'm not alone there, because Luciano Berio said that one of his... of course he used it in Sinfonia. Yeah. So, you know, look, I could talk about this all day, because I think it goes into all sorts of important socio-political areas with the hip movement and the getting rid of certain... styles, thinking that you're being authentic.
So, but to a listener of this set of contrapunti,
yeah.
They're going to hear a variety of these things happening through the course of these four different fugues.
Well, to the end, I'm actually inspired, as I was saying, by the Swingle singers and Wendy Carlos,
yeah.
you know, who, of course, when we were growing up, I mean, you know, switched on, but hello.
Yes.
But actually, you listen to it now. It's like listening to Jacques Lussier, bless him, he's just passed. Yes. But hello, some of the finest playing. And Wendy Carlos, one of the great pioneers. Mm-hmm. And so I've sort of imbibed these spirits in a perfectly authentic and sincere way, and indeed written into the music, into the musicians, you know, iPads, onto their iPads, written, you know, the sort of in the spirit of Stokowski. So it goes all the way through. And you see, if you were to say, oh, some purist, well, what is a purist these days? I mean, what, you mean someone who believes in 1977 early music movement from what country? Name it, you know, because they were totally different anyway, the Dutch, the English, and the Austrians, to name but three.
Right.
So, you know, you asked, and that's my attitude to the interpretation of the art of the fugue, because it is such an open book. You know, we don't.
Oh, it's complete freedom.
Really sure why I wrote it. You know, like the three Mozart last symphonies. So that's my attitude. I sort of stubbornly hold my ground for polystylism in Bach these days, especially when, you know. I think the early music movement ought to be really focused on hardware rather than claims. You know, often putrid claims of what, you know, I mean, if I had more time, I'd go into it. And being one of them, I feel like I can sort of stand, you know, on a fort and make an argument against and for. But the putrid claims of having the answer, you know, this is what the composer intended. Scoff.
But okay, so then you get to Beethoven, this Opus 130. Are we talking in the same realm there? Because we do pretty much know what Beethoven had in mind for this, don't we? I mean, am I wrong?
Yeah, well, yes and no. I don't have to be polystylistic with Beethoven, because if you're not in your interpretation, you're going to... come on. So he's got this strange German dance, whatever that means, the Tedesca, right? With all those strange hairpins. Can I talk in sort of...
Please.
With these bizarre hairpins. And if you don't do them, you're not doing what's on the page. And if you do them to, you know, an ear who doesn't know what's on the page, or, you know, then you're gonna let people down no matter what with this piece. It'll be overdone, underdone, you know, for all sorts of tastes. I think anyone who claims that the quartet works better, it really hasn't listened enough to orchestral arrangements of the Grosse Fugue. I think, you know, he's written it as though it's on some sort of steroidal, you know, sort of got some sort of steroidal chemicals there. And so we can unleash the beasts, the monsters, even more with the orchestra. Goodness, to even begin to...
Let's just take one simple question, which is, do you take the string quartet and just distribute the parts among the orchestra for a bigger sound? Is that how this starts, or is this arrangement...
Yeah, I mean, Michael Gielen, who recently passed, the conductor, I listened to his... arrangement of it, and he adds the octave at the beginning, and it's something rings a bell that in a sketch Beethoven had early on had that upper octave and then removed it. So I paid due attention to that and decided no, it lives better at the tessitura that Beethoven gave us. There's no soloing in that. We just simply play as written, so there's no it's just again steroids, we're on steroids. But in the other movements we do the whole, you know, solo tutti thing, but it's not a reworking of parts like I say do with the Schubert Death and the Maiden slow movement, the movement, or Janacek Kreutzer. So you know, and a lot of people say, well, you know, gee, how do you arrange a quartet? We say, no, we just simply play the quartet.
So what does that do for a listener? I mean, especially listeners who don't even know the quartet, when they come in,
that's
and that it's
no, I'll say, okay, so here we go. So a lot of people, we went through a sort of phase of, you know, the critic, you know, saying, oh, the quartet is ruined, the intimacy of the quartet is, you know, sullied by... Okay, but don't listen to it as a quartet. Listen to it as though he wrote it, or she, or whoever wrote the piece, as a piece of strings. And then if you were to hear it as a quartet, it would sound, oh, denuded of... Yeah. And proof of the pudding is in the eating, right? So we used to play in this Rebecca series in the Concertgebouw. And the then presenter said, oh, look, I love having you, but can you please not play all these string quartets? And I said, okay, so what? We're going to play Elgar, Tchaikovsky, or Dvorak serenades, right? Hello? You know, there's not much repertoire for strings. And he said, well, why don't you play that terrific chamber symphony of Shostakovich? And I said, oh, you mean the eighth string quartet, which you know is a chamber symphony. So there's my point. Now, Chopin, and correct me if I'm wrong, but he first heard Beethoven, late Beethoven's string quartet, Opus 131, I think, four massed strings in Paris, and thought, this is the bee's knees, best ever. You know, as for my own relationship with late Beethoven string quartets as a kid, I first heard Opus 131, conducted by Bernstein, in the... I think it was the Metropolis arrangement of, or rearrangement of the quartet. And when I went intimate and put on a quartet, I don't remember who was playing it, I missed that initial burst, you know, of the orchestra playing. So it really depends on how, you know, what you're used to. I mean, I remember a lady saying... about a rendition of Bach Brandenburg Concerto we did once in Australia, and she was overheard saying, I prefer my Bach slower. Now, the pronoun, I mean, the my. So you have ownership. As soon as you hear something and you love it, it's yours, isn't it? So a lot of people do have a sort of sense of propriety over a quartet. You know, it's a quartet, it's an intimate experience, and then you come along with an orchestra and ruin the intimacy. No. I argue when we're adding something to the intimacy, but this quartet, Opus 130, almost demands it in their Grosse Fuge. So,
tell me about the soloists that you choose to work with, because on this tour you've got Paul Lewis and you've got Enon Barnatan for some of the concerts, and both of those guys are just unbelievably beautiful players. What do you hope to find with a soloist when you're kind of casting about and you're talking to managers and figuring out who might be available? Who is it that you're looking for? What qualities are you looking for?
Well, there are so many issues at play there. Look, the repertoire, you know, so we had to play something like a Mozart piano concerto. So someone had to be able to, you know, tickle the ivories with a sense of awareness for playing Mozart on a grand piano. Paul Lewis we've played with now quite a lot. In fact, I think we played here last time with Paul Lewis. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I'd have to look that one up.
And Enon Barnatan was recommended to us by the Lincoln Center. And so, you know, that match was made. Often it's a very satisfying forced relationship, as in, you're sort of the match is made by the promoter. But of course we have right of refusal, and in this case, God, there'd be no right of refusal here. Both are very different artists. But having said that, both bring a clarity to Mozart, which is very important. I'm not into the sort of silk handkerchief performances that you get of Mozart piano concertos for this reason, that when you hear the hardware, listen to the hardware that Mozart wrote it for and for himself to play, the pussyfooting that you get on a grand piano just doesn't happen. Like you can really force that old piano into places that you can't force a grand piano. And so if you really play lightly, and a lot of forte pianists make this mistake when they're playing the forte piano, they're amazing, you know, and the whole piano is sort of rattling. And then they go onto a grand piano and their lightness of touch turns it into a bit of a, you know, a toy keyboard. Mm-hmm. So, but both these pianists, you know, they're grand pianists, but they bring a sense of great clarity. One thing that I really insist in Mozart is this humor thing. I don't mean just telling, you know, jokes, but to have this sense of humor that you get in, or humorous attitude that you get, that pervades a lot of his opera buffa, you know, the Marriage of Figaro, Magic Flute, of course, not Mitridate, when he wrote when he was 13, or La Clementa di Tito, but you know, that sort of extraordinary lightness of being, and that you can tell incredibly serious stories through this lightness of being. And for me, that's so important with Mozart. And if you lack that, I'm going to fall asleep in your concerts. And I think a lot of other people will too. And I think you lack something that's an essential part of Mozart. It's funny because the five violin concertos, which he wrote, you know, very early on, like, you know, pre-20s, so late teens. And then he moved on. He never touched the medium again, unfortunately. And unfortunately, never wrote a cello concerto. But you've got... It's sort of like he was practicing his opera style in those concertos, pretty much the last three concertos in those style. And the piano concertos often, you find, have this style as well. And this one certainly does. K414 in A major.
You've been with the ACO for...
Way too long.
Oh. I was just going to say, a long time. What do you see coming for the ACO and you?
Look, good question. Okay, so 10 years ago, if I had left, which I thought I was going to do, I would have missed out on the amazing opportunity to have this instrument fund, which is a kind of... Well, it's beyond our wildest dreams, let me put
this
it.
This is where a lot of the players in the orchestra are playing Stradivari and Guarneri.
So I myself play on a very famous Del Gesù Guarneri from 1743, which is the sister violin to Paganini's own violin, the Il Canone. We have one of the strongest strads, called the Hilton, now called the Bel Giorno. We have a Del Gesù cello, if you can believe it, a Guarneri cello. We've got two exquisite Amatis, one a cello, one a violin. We've got Isolde Menges's Guarneri. I mean, and the list goes on and on. So, but it's not not everyone has an access to these great instruments. So, I want to bring that to completion. And then there's a lot of really experimental stuff that we've embarked on that has made it through to the mainstream. Mm-hmm. We've made surf films. It's not enough time really to go into it, but one called The Reef, which is really experimental. I mean, we had Ligeti ramifications with a, you know, garbage dump behind a very famous surfing spot in Australia. It's sort of visual exploration of, and I think it's true to Ligeti's music, this sort of very complex webs of detritus. And I'm actually quoting him there, or paraphrasing him. But then that's led to quite a successful, mainstream project called Mountain, which was an exploration of mountains directed by a lady called Jen Peedham, who made Sherpa, well worth a watch, and narrated by Willem Dafoe. Mm-hmm. And we play music. It's think Baraka.
Is this sort of activist environmentalist, or is it more artistic?
It's artistic. I mean, you couldn't help but read something. Everything's environmental these days. But no, it's born of art. It's born of music, and it's born of imagery that insinuates something. But I like to say that with the movies that we make, that you hear more with your eyes and you see more with your ears in this context.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Richard Tognetti, it's fantastic to talk with you. I wish we could talk all day. There's a lot we could talk about, apparently, but I'm going to let you get on and get to rehearsal and all that.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks for having me, and it's wonderful to be back here.
Thanks a lot.